Hello, welcome to the Michael Corrin Show, and it's a Thursday, and Tuesdays and Thursdays we do whatever we want to do. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday we have these set panels and we debate all the major issues. Tuesday and Thursday a selection, federal politics, foreign affairs, faith matters, culture, oh, loads of stuff really, one-on-one interviews. We thought we'd tackle the issue, fairly important I suppose, does God exist? Yeah, apparently he does. Does God exist? Debate the issue. There's a whole series of these debates going around North America. I moderated one in Oshawa, Ontario, just last week. Almost 4,000 people were there, most of them students, almost 4,000. That's a lot of people, and there is huge interest in this subject. Personally, I welcome these signs on buses. God probably doesn't exist. Yeah, let's bring the debate on. Let's have everyone have their freedom of expression here. Does God exist? We'll debate this issue. At the end of it, one person will win. The other one will probably be burning in hell. Let's introduce them. Dr. William Lane Craig, Research Professor of Philosophy, Talbot School of Theology, La Mirada, California. Hello.
Hello.
We haven't got any of your books. We should we could try and sell them for you, but that's okay. Michael Payton, a cognitive scientist at York University. Are you allowed to go to classes these days? Or
no, unfortunately not. It's really a shame what's happening at the university with this strike.
It is a great shame. I think what we'll do, we haven't arranged this before the show, we'll go segment by segment, and we won't be too formal about it. Begin with you, sir. The proposition, does God exist? If he does, show me how. Show me why.
Well, I think there are a number of good reasons to think that God exists. In the debates that I've been having here in Canada, I typically present five reasons and then defend them in greater detail. God is the best explanation for the origin of the universe. God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. God is the best explanation for the existence of objective moral values in the world. God is the best explanation for the historical facts concerning the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And God can be immediately known and experienced. And on that basis, I think it's rational to conclude that God exists.
There are no alternative explanations as to why we exist, how we exist, and how the world...
Oh, certainly. Began. Certainly there are alternative explanations, and I don't mean to suggest that atheism is irrational or anything of that sort, but I'm suggesting that the best explanation, the more plausible one, is the one that I defend.
Where does evolution come into all this?
It doesn't come into any of the arguments that I present, because the second argument I give, the design argument, doesn't concern the origin of biological complexity. It concerns the remarkable fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe given in the Big Bang that scientists have only begun to discover within the last 40 years or so. So that for a biological evolution to take place anywhere in the universe, you have to have this elaborately set table in advance in the initial conditions of the Big Bang that cries out for some sort of explanation.
How old is the world?
Best estimates today are around 13.7 billion years or so.
Now, this is good, you see. This is a position I can embrace, because there are people who will sit here and say, no, it's 6,500 years old. That is not a tenable position?
I don't think it's plausible. The arguments that I give are right in line with mainstream science. I'm not bucking up against mainstream science in presenting these arguments. Rather, I'm going with the flow of what contemporary cosmology and astrophysics supports.
Is there a contradiction or an inconsistency between the biblical account of the age of the Earth and your statement?
Well, that's interesting, because there isn't any biblical account of the age of the Earth. There's nothing in the Genesis or elsewhere in the Bible that says how old the universe is. So, no, I don't think it is incompatible.
We often hear that the rather caricatured argument that Christians believe that man and dinosaur coexisted.
There are some creationists, they typically style themselves young earth creationists, who believe that. I've even seen children's books where Noah takes dinosaur eggs on the ark with him. Well, all of this is reading between the lines. There's nothing like that in the book of Genesis.
Forgive these questions. In a perfect world, I wouldn't have to ask them. But if God is all good and all powerful and all knowing, why does he allow bad things to happen to good people?
This is, I think, the principal argument for the atheistic side that my opponents in the debates will sometimes bring up. And I think that there's a couple of ways to respond to this. First, We need to understand what the atheist is claiming here. Is he arguing that God and suffering are logically incompatible with each other? If he is, then he needs to show that there's some sort of implicit contradiction there, because there's no explicit contradiction. And I would say that no atheist has ever been able to sustain that burden of proof, to show that there are necessarily true assumptions that would reveal some kind of a contradiction between God and the suffering and evil in the world. In fact, I think we can prove that they are compatible by just adding a third proposition, and that would be that God has morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil and suffering in the world. As long as that's even possible, it shows that God and evil are logically compatible. So that logical version of the argument doesn't work. Now, very quickly, there's a probabilistic version of the argument which says, all right, God and evil are logically compatible, but nevertheless, it's highly improbable that God exists, given the evil and suffering in the world. And I think there's a number of moves that the theist can make in response to that argument to show that it's not improbable that God exists, given the suffering in the world.
I happen to believe, and I'm trying to be as objective as I can throughout the debate, that the reasons why there is suffering and pain are entirely obvious, and in fact they're inevitable if there is a loving God. But how would you explain them? Why then does God have to allow discomfort, suffering, pain, terrible pain sometimes to exist?
Well, I would say, Michael, that there isn't any single reason. Rather, there's a multitude of reasons that would be in play here. One would be that God wants to create a world of free creatures who can become responsible moral agents and mature persons. And that will require a world that operates according to certain natural laws, where the fire that warms you can also burn you, the water that sustains you can drown you. And it would require the ability of these creatures to do morally evil acts. And so creating that sort of an arena, I think, is going to allow the possibility of natural suffering and moral evil to occur. But that God permits these with the overall goal in mind of bringing people freely into a knowledge of himself and to eternal salvation. And the goal of human life is not happiness in this life. We are not God's pets. His goal is not to create a nice terrarium here for his human pets. Rather, it is to bring persons into communion with himself forever, freely. And in order to do that, it's not at all implausible that a world suffused with natural and moral evil would be the correlative of that.
Okay. When we come back, we'll hear the first 7-8 minutes of The Other Side. I promise you. Don't go away. We know where you are. Welcome back, Michael Corrin's show. Does God exist? One of those questions we sometimes come to every now and again, even on television. Does God exist?
Probably not.
Why? How?
Well, in my experience, I've never heard or seen of a single argument that would demonstrate necessarily that God exists. Right? I think there's a lot of speculation about sort of supernatural causes to the universe, that type of thing. But I don't see any necessary belief that we have to accept in the same way that we'd accept many other logical arguments.
Mm-hmm. What about what you heard for the first 7 minutes there?
Well, actually, I think there should be a distinction between one of the five arguments that you gave. One of them was the personal appreciation for God. So I think the distinction that Thomas Aquinas used between revealed theology and natural theology is important here, that we have to understand that perhaps people did have or do still have personal religious experiences, but we have to question whether or not that would be under the same frame of debate as talking about natural theology, which should be from first principles.
Mm. That's hardly the center of Aquinas' writing, though, of course. I mean, that's marginal. He was really arguing from a very similar point of view as what we heard here. Mm-hmm. But putting aside any question of subjective feeling or personal experience, because by its nature, those can always be accepted or
right.
rejected. We heard arguments about, for example, the origin of the Earth. Accidentality simply doesn't explain. An acceptance, perhaps, of an evolutionary pattern, but there had to be some sort of imagination design initially.
Why?
You tell me.
Well, I don't see any reason why we'd assume that there had to be an intelligent force behind that. I think it's really up to Dr. Craig to explain to us why that is a necessary truth, not for me to defend why.
Well, I can give him more time, but then people will write in and say, oh, you gave him too much time.
Okay, well, I'll address what other people have often said, which is that because the universe seems to be set up for us to exist, is this correct? Is this about what you think?
That it's fine-tuned for intelligent life.
Okay, well,
again, whether us or others.
Well, okay. Then whatever life would exist out of randomness, whatever intelligent life would exist out of randomness, I think that there's an important point about evolution which is being made here, right? Which is that, of course, evolved systems had to come about in this system, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. Mm-hmm. Also, that there's a pretty strong intuition for us to believe that we have a central role in the universe, right? I think it was Wittgenstein was very key on this point, where he was once asked, he was once said, once told by someone, how ridiculous was it when people thought that the sun revolved around the earth? And he asked, well, how would it look if the earth revolved around the sun? That is how it looks, right? So I think the same questions is very pertinent here. How would it look if it were random, right? It seems to me that it would look very much like the Earth we inhabit and the universe that we see today.
Interesting you quote Wittgenstein, actually. I would have thought he'd probably have a little bit more sympathy with the side than yours.
He was definitely a Catholic.
He was Jewish, actually, but he moved through to Catholicism.
Yeah.
I'm trying to give you as much opportunity as possible. I'm not hearing, right, I heard a concrete argument here, and I want to give you the opportunity to respond in some form. Let me be more broad in the question. Give me the brief thesis as to why we should not believe in God.
Well, why we shouldn't believe in God really depends on what you mean by belief. Whether or not we should accept the arguments really has to do with whether they correspond with the facts.
Well, there can be no absolute certainty that there isn't or there is. I mean, obviously, you're an intelligent man. You would never say atheist. I mean, atheism is rationally impossible. You can strongly doubt. You can strongly believe. If there was absolute proof, then God wouldn't be loving. He wouldn't give us freedom. There has to be that room and not to believe. You have to want to find him.
Right.
But so why, speaking to viewers out there, hundreds of thousands of people watching, why would you say to them, God is irrelevant, don't bother?
Well, I would say that it's more important, actually, for them to examine the reasons why they would believe in God, right? I'd actually think that that's really the first step, is to appreciate the role of skepticism and the role of taking arguments seriously and investigating them to the best of their abilities. Mm-hmm. I think that would likely lead to atheism. I don't think that it's necessary for people to have arguments for being atheists, rather that they should come to the conclusion that makes the most sense to them.
Why?
Because, well, otherwise then you're deluding yourself. If you're not actually thinking about what you believe, I don't think any Christian would agree that you should believe it, or that you should believe in something simply because it was told to you. You should investigate it. I just think that that would lead to someone to be an atheist.
We seem to be going around in circles here. But the reason we're having the debate is, does God exist?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, it's a self-evident truth that I believe in debate on these issues.
Right.
I want you to tell people why they shouldn't believe, if you want to use the semantics, why they shouldn't imagine there's a God. Why? Show me how there's no God. Give me proof that God doesn't exist.
Well, we can't prove a negative. I think that's why we're going around in circles. Like, I can't prove the non-existence of
Give
anything.
Me an argument.
An argument. I think, actually, it was one that wasn't fully addressed by Dr. Craig.
Yeah.
The argument, I think, is the argument from evil, right? I have tended away from it in the past, but I do think it attacks something that's very central to the Christian doctrine, which is the actual nature of God, right? Whether or not they can be actually all good, all knowing, and all powerful at the same time. Now, this argument has changed a lot from its original conception about like 1600 years ago, right? And we have to be careful of what, how we take that argument to be. But what we do see, I think, is that it is incompatible to believe that there is genuine evil in the world, that we can believe in a being that is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. Now, what theists tend to do is to attack this idea of evil and say that it's, well, not really evil, right? And that it's actually just in light of some greater good. Now, I think that that's actually a very problematic position to take, because what you're doing actually is you're not giving an objective morality, right? What you're doing actually is to be basically an apologist for whatever God happens to do, right?
Yeah, I have to say, the only people I have heard who say there is genuine evil are, as you say, theists, because, for example, there's no evil in the animal kingdom.
Right.
People kill for food. There's some mild torture, a cat with a mouse, but overwhelmingly there's no ethnic cleansing or genocide, it's simply need.
Right.
But there is evil within humanity, and the theists would say we have souls, but there is a spiritual war going on. Mm-hmm. It's been actually atheists who've said to me there are bad people, there's no supernatural evil.
Well, it depends on what you mean by a supernatural evil. Certainly not, like, I wouldn't hold the position that there's some evil force in the world, or there's such a thing as the devil, or, like, that to me, I think, is ludicrous.
Yeah.
But I think there are genuine arguments for why things are ethically bad, and if that's what you mean by evil, if that's what you take to mean by evil, then there are certainly reasons why we'd have an objectively unethical behavior.
Right.
Right?
But not with animals, only with people.
Well, it depends on the level of cognition that we're attributing to animals, right? Whether or not they can be moral agents, as well as moral objects.
Does an animal ever kill merely for the sport of it?
We see in chimpanzees, actually, that there is this sort of behavior.
What do they go for? What part of the anatomy do they attack first?
Actually, from my knowledge, it was the testicles.
Yes, they do, because they're trying to stop their opponents from breeding. It's meant to be a selfish act. It's not meant to be evil. It's not meant to be Satan. It's meant to be, I must stop you winning in the end. However, plenty of time to go in the debate. Back in a few moments on monkey testes. See you soon. Debate, home, we're back. Does God exist is the issue. In the commercial break, we were discussing baboons ripping off. back to you, sir. This notion of evil, because having done talk radio for many years, it's the standard reset position, why does God allow? Now, it seems to me that if you believe life ends when you're 80, 90 years old or whatever, it's a real issue. There's evil in the world. If you believe it goes on and God doesn't guarantee a good life, he guarantees a perfect eternity, and that we have to have the freedom to go wrong, and that God is most unhappy when we go wrong, but it has to be allowed. Would they be the arguments, or are they just comforting, comfortable positions to explain why there's so many bad things in the world?
Oh, I think it's very important to understand here, Michael, it's the atheist who has the burden of proof with respect to this argument. As you quite rightly, I think, pressed Michael to give us an argument that God does not exist. So if Michael wants to say that God and evil in the world are logically incompatible with each other, he needs to give us an argument to show that that's the case. And so if you can offer these possibilities,
if I may,
yes,
then what is actually being attacked is the conception of God, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to have some sort of clear definition of what God is before we can actually talk about anything.
Okay.
So if I'm wrong in the assumption that the Christian idea of God, which I assumed you would be defending,
yes,
is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good,
yes,
then why do we see evil in the world, or why do we see the necessity for evil?
Now, asking a question, though, Michael, isn't an argument. If you're going to claim that an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God is incompatible with evil, those aren't explicitly contradictory. So if you're going to maintain they're implicitly contradictory, there are some hidden premises here that you're assuming that we need to
Isn't there a contradiction, then, in the... Isn't there a contradiction in that an all powerful being who would want only the best for the world would allow bad things to happen, right? And you don't see any contradiction.
Well, let me ask you, the God that you speak of, does he want all good for the world?
I would say that God certainly wants the best for us, but remember what I said in the earlier segment. That doesn't mean happiness in this life. On the Christian view, the good for man is to be found in relation to God. And so God's overall plan for humanity is to bring people freely into a loving relationship with himself now and forever. And it is not at all implausible that only in a world involving enormous amounts of suffering and moral evil that that would be accomplished. So we've got to get away from the idea that we are God's pets and his goal is to create a nice little environment for his human pets, at least on Christianity. Well, I think that's false.
I think there's something important, though, that you're missing, and that is that there seems to be a displacement of suffering in the world that I think a lot of people who live in Africa who are starving right now as we speak don't have the luxury of sitting in nice leather chairs and talking about these like philosophical issues.
Why are so many of them Christian?
Sorry?
Exactly.
Why are so many of them Christian?
Oh, there's actually, there are great reasons for people who are destitute to believe in God, right? That I think it gives a lot of comfort to people in that type of area, especially also, like we have to, I think, also acknowledge there is an economic force, that there is a great need or desire from religious people in our societies to convert those people. So, of course, it's going to work on some of them, especially when you're dealing with people who are destitute that don't have very many reasons to object to some offering.
Are we in the dangerous area here of touching on the racist? I mean, could it be that people who are not splashing around in materialism and decadence maybe have a purer, more pristine vision of what really matters in the world?
I'm sorry, I'm not really following why that what the racist comment meant.
Because you're black doesn't mean you're stupid. For me to be crass about it, and you say destitute throughout Africa and Asia, there are people who I mean, they're not all destitute. Far from it, they would argue, and I've heard some of the most brilliant people in the world, who are African bishops, for example, they would argue this isn't true at all. But we can actually see clearly through the window. You're too busy cleaning away how much money, how many cars, how many homes. What you've said, what you seem to imply at the very least is, well, if you're really poor and really needy, then you'll believe.
In other words, it may be the materialism, consumerism, and wealth of the West that is actually the spiritual impediment to knowing God and his life.
Last minute to you, go ahead.
Let me address that, because I certainly didn't mean it to come off as racist. It's not because they're black, right? It's because they're desperate. Right. So if someone has no ability, no education to properly think out these problems, then I think it's unlikely that they'll be able to withstand constantly being told something. Yeah. Right. I think that's true of anyone, even in our society. So I certainly don't think it's racist.
No, I'm sure you're not. But again, there's an assumption here that people who may not have very much money are not educated. In fact, often you have a higher literacy rate in countries that face relative poverty than here. And what is a challenge we have in the West? People, so many people, very sadly, sometimes necessary, on antidepressants. We have suicide attempts. Look at the suicide rates in a country like Scandinavia, for example, in that region there. So wealthy, suicide rates so high compared to parts of Southern Africa. Are we not confusing things here? Are we not in a rather, forgive me, smug way saying they believe because?
Well, forgive me if it sounds smug, but I do think there is some truth and validity to the fact that there are economic impulses which are used in missionary work, and that's really all I was saying.
Okay.
As for the issue of like depression, especially in our culture, I think that there's a lot to be said about that, but I wouldn't assume by any means that just because we're in relative wealth that we'd have happy lives. Like, that doesn't follow at all.
I think we're in extraordinary, extreme wealth, actually. But,
Oh, well, certainly. I'd agree with that.
Commercials, nice segue. Wealth commercials, buy things, spend your money, then come straight back to us. We'll see you very soon.
Welcome back. Michael Gorin Show at halftime. And at halftime, we reintroduce the panel. They're still here. Dr. William Lane Craig, he's a professor of philosophy, Talbot School of Theology, La Mirada, California. I don't even know where that is, actually.
Los Angeles suburbs.
Oh, is it? Mm. Oh, didn't know. Michael Payton, cognitive scientist, York University, a Toronto suburb, I suppose.
I think that's about right.
Yeah, we do what we can here. You have these debates frequently. You're an apologist. Doesn't mean that you say sorry. You justify, you explain the Christian faith in this case. I mentioned at the top of the show almost 4,000 people, a debate I moderated. Mm. Most of them students, and I would say two-thirds, if not more, seem to support the Christian speaker. But there is a popular assumption somehow that the clever people are the atheists. Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, the clever people, they call Christians, was it the dumbs?
Well, they refer to themselves as the brights.
Do they?
So I suppose that suggests the others are dim bulbs.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of ridiculous, though, because just because we call homosexuals gays doesn't mean everyone else is glums, right? I think that there's a reason why we call ourselves brights, or some people call themselves brights. But there are differences in what we call ourselves.
But how do you react to that? I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. I'm not brilliant, but I'm not a fool. He seems pretty clever.
Yeah.
Some of the most brilliant people I've met have been devout Christian believers. I've met some very clever people who aren't. But can't we just disagree rather than label one group bright? That seems a rather grand self-description.
It's not them being labeled, it's them labeling themselves that way. So I don't really appreciate the name bright. I think there's a point to that being a bit snarky in a way.
Yeah.
But as for like the intellectualism that happens to be around atheism, I think that comes about because there are fundamentalists who are very intellectual, right? You two don't happen to be those people, but there is that element, and that's a genuine concern of a lot of people.
Well, there are. I mean, without any doubt, within all religions, there are fundamentalists, and fundamentalism by its nature can be rather close to the outside world and thus outside ideas. But as someone I mentioned talk radio earlier, who for years has hosted a talk radio show, I meet so-called atheists every day who can barely tie their shoes.
Well, I think that's true. That's why I said at the beginning that it's important to understand why you are an atheist, not that you are an atheist, right? Having those good reasons to, and that's explicitly why I put that in the beginning.
Right.
There are people who are atheists, right? And atheism only really describes just lack of theism. So that would accurately describe like Joseph Stalin as well as Bertrand Russell, even though they disagree on basically everything.
Let me ask you about that, because Bertrand Russell, of course, who is well known for being a non-believer, later in his life said, I can no longer use the word atheist because I realize that intellectually it's not sustainable. He said, I don't believe there's a God, but as a materialist, unless, and by the way, materialism doesn't, of course, mean just wanting things.
Right.
As a materialist, unless I can see everything, I can never say there is no God. I can believe there's no God, I doubt there's a God, but I can never say there is no God. I will no longer use the word atheist.
Right, and I think in that passage, and Dawkins takes this up as well, he says that well, we can't really be sure, but that's where his teapot argument comes in, or the likeness to like the flying spaghetti monster and fairies. And actually, the fairies one, I think, is not as silly as it sounds, right? Because there were periods of time there were periods of time and places where people genuinely believed in fairies. Like in my own family, actually, my great-grandfather genuinely in England believed that there were little people that
the bottom of the garden.
Yeah, exactly. and they were responsible. They're actually very active in their own lives. Like if you lost something in your house, then it was believed that the little people had taken it, and there are just these little nymphs running around.
He didn't become prime minister, did he?
Oh no! No, that would be horrifying. I think that's. So I don't think that's as offensive as it sounds. That like if we believe that there's no reasons anymore for believing in fairies. I think likely we won't find very many good reasons for believing in God in the future.
I haven't met many people, I have to admit, who believe in fairies. And
not now, but that's largely my point, is that that we've gotten to the stage where we've realized more about, especially about how the memory system works, right? So it's likely that you simply forgot that you put the spoon in the dish, right? And I think, likely, in the future that there'll be a time when a lot of these arguments are actually quite old for theism.
Doesn't seem to. Arthur Conan, I read a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle, not a very good biography, but a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes' creator. And of course, he did believe in fairies, and he had photographs from a couple of Yorkshire schoolgirls he was convinced were genuine. But he abandoned Catholicism. He was raised a Catholic to become a spiritualist. I hear atheists talk about Santa Claus is a standard one. There'll be emails tonight from really clever people saying, yo, your friend Santa. People who believe in Santa Claus, I believed in Santa Claus when I was 5, 6, 7. Mm-hmm. Probably not true. As I grew older, reached the age of maturity, thought, read, understood, I abandoned the idea. I wasn't raised in a Christian home. As I got older, read, matured, understood, I developed a belief in God. There's overwhelming evidence to show that as people grow, often they increase their belief in God. There's overwhelming evidence to show that as people grow older, unless they have some sort of mental instability, they refuse to believe in Santa anymore. They're totally contradictory.
Well, actually, I'd say that I think you're drawing a parallel that doesn't really exist, right?
Yeah, because just showed it does.
I'd say that belief in God, especially when you cite statistics that say that people become more religious when they get older, I think that that's largely because there's the tendency not to become religious, but because of the nature of the demographics and how poor the research has been in the last 100 years, that older people tend to be religious simply because...
over 14 or 15. Well, okay, let's make it simpler then. How many people over the age of 21 are convinced there's a Santa Claus? How many people over the age of 21 are convinced there's a God? And the people over 21 didn't believe in God in an earlier age, but did believe in Santa. I mean, quite clearly, people abandon a sense in some things as they become mature, and they embrace a belief often when they become mature. So to compare the belief in God with the belief in Santa or fairies, it's one of those digressionary arguments that are put forward. It doesn't really address the real issue.
Oh, no, well... I was actually giving that in response to something earlier that you had said. So what my point was bringing up fairies is that we have no evidence for fairies, right? And similarly, there's no evidence or necessary evidence for God.
Good point to go to break. We'll ask you that when we come back. And the fairy community, I mean, I meant no harm. Anyway, back in a few moments on the Michael Carr Show. Interesting point being made here. Fairies, there's no evidence that they exist, but equally, where's the evidence that God does exist?
I think the disanalogy is the following. We have good evidence that fairies do not exist. The reason people don't believe in Santa Claus is not simply there's a lack of evidence for him. There's good evidence that there is no such person. By contrast, with respect to God, I think we have both good evidence for the existence of God that I enumerated earlier, but I don't think Michael can present any good argument that there is no God. The atheist here has a burden of proof to sustain his claim that there is no such being as God, and I don't think this is a burden that the atheist can carry. I would like to come back to an earlier point, if I may, too, and that is the notion that atheists are somehow the intelligentsia among us and so forth. I think this is just completely false. The spate of new books published by the new atheists like Harris and Hitchens and Dawkins and so forth are not sophisticated books intellectually. These are, for the most part, angry, bitter diatribes against religion. And while someone like Dawkins may be a good scientist in his field, when he begins to talk about philosophy and theology, he is merely a layman. And The God Delusion is a very unsophisticated book intellectually. As a philosopher, I was just appalled at the arguments he gives in that book. It is an embarrassment, really, I think.
Well, I can agree, and I suspect Michael may as well.
I think he would, too.
If you look at the reviews, this man is respected in his field.
Yes.
But this book, if you look at the reviews, they're quite damning. I used to work with Chris Hitchens. He's a bright guy. He's a fun guy. This is not a profound book. It's a fun book in many ways. So I think most people would agree that the three you mentioned in particular, Dawkins, Harris, and Hitchens, what they've written is not first-class scholarship. However, there are first-class scholars and genuine intellectuals who do not believe at all in
God. Certainly there are, Michael. But there has also been, especially over the last 50 years, since the late 1960s, a literal revolution in my discipline, philosophy, in the Anglo-American world, which has brought about a renaissance of Christian philosophy, such that some of our finest philosophers at our most prestigious universities are now outspoken Bible-believing Christians.
Sir?
Where is this philosophical revolution taking place?
In the Anglo-American realm.
The ones dominated by assumed atheists, like people like Iyer, people like Bertrand Russell, who really dominated. Like, well, I'm sorry, I just never have
what
heard
was the first
this.
Thing you said?
I think you meant Ayer.
Oh, from
A.J.
Yeah.
Ayer.
A.J. Ayer.
But that's a bygone generation, Michael. I'm talking about today.
Okay, let's talk about people from today, like Quine, right?
He's dead too.
Well, he died only a couple of years. Like,
so did Freddie
Ayer,
but I mean,
let's talk
AJ,
about, let's name names, people like Richard Swinburne at Oxford University, Robert and Marilyn Adams at Oxford, Brian Leftow at Oxford, people like Alvin Plantinga at University of Notre Dame, Peter Van Inwagen, Dallas Willard, Eleanor Stump. I mean, I could go on and on naming names at top universities in America and England who are outspoken Christians, such that the face of my discipline, compared to the 1930s and 40s, when Russell and Ayer were dominant, has been utterly transformed.
Well, I'd have to disagree. I do know something about the philosophical tradition and what's going on in it now. I think that I think you're frankly just choosing people that are theists, right? And even if there were theists who are also philosophers, it doesn't follow at all that that the position is philosophically justified just because a philosopher is.
No, but it does follow that it is not true that the brights are all these atheists. That's just not the case.
Well, I think that's probably established. I mean, there are, at Oxford, without doubt, that there is a whole new wave of Christian believers. Mm-hmm. Equally, there are some extremely vocal anti-Christian believers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't alter the argument. We can agree, perhaps, I hope this is a fairly sophisticated setting, that there are bright people on both sides. There are intelligent, informed, decent people on both sides. It doesn't alter or affect the argument in any way. And on a purely practical level, before we close this segment, in the UK, buses on the side, God probably doesn't exist, so just sit back and relax. I rather applaud that. I think it's wonderful, as long as the other side is allowed to say God probably does exist, stop being neurotic and whatever. But freedom of expression surely is a fundamental of any open civilized debate.
Absolutely. I think we can all agree on that. What I would disagree with is the implication of the slogan that the existence of God is a trivial question that needn't bother you. Forget about it. Go ahead and enjoy your life. I think that's extremely naive. When you read the writings of atheists themselves, Friedrich Nietzsche, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, they recognized that the conclusion of atheism was an agonizing conclusion that meant that ultimately life was without meaning, value, purpose.
True.
I don't think I could disagree with you more. I think you've got it basically exactly wrong. Especially out of someone like Jean-Paul Sartre, right? And I'd like to just ask you exactly where you think this despair out of Sartre's work is coming from. Okay. Like, could you quote a piece of literature?
Right. Let's break, then come back and straight to that and give you some more time as well. In a few moments on the Michael Karin Show. Okay.
If you would like to contact The Michael Koren Show, please write to The Michael Koren Show at 1295 North Service Road, Burlington, Ontario, L7R4X5, or send an email to info@michaelkoren.com. If you would like to know more about CTS-TV, we invite you to visit our website at ctstv.com.
Straight to it. You wanted to know where is despair evident in Sartre's writing, was it?
Yes, and in particular, like if you could point us to a piece of writing where you think that's
well,
important.
The whole basis of his existential philosophy that comes out in books like Being and Nothingness is that we do not find ourselves with a God-given, pre-established set of values because he's an atheist. and that therefore each individual must create his own values for himself, create his own meaning in life, which leads instantly to relativism, subjectivism, and individualism.
I don't think that's true. I don't think that follows at all. I think that it's committing the fallacy of Dostoevsky to believe that just because God doesn't exist, that everything is permitted. And that simply doesn't follow at all. There are obviously good reasons to be an ethical person and to have reasons for your life. Well, for instance, I think that there are reasons to be good simply by the fact that we feel a necessity to do so, right? I think that innately, and I do study moral cognition, moral psychology, mm-hmm. that's actually where my work is, right. is being focused, that there are basis of feeling empathy towards other beings, right? And I think even if we had, I'd emphasize also that this empathy has to be established even in a Christian tradition. Like, if you go from the Bible, you're not going to get objective morality. It's actually impossible to. It doesn't follow from, because ultimately what you'll be doing is either you'll be saying there is an objective morality that God happens to be following, or you'd be saying that
it can't happen to follow it if it's objective.
Sorry?
You can't happen to follow if it's objective. It's either objective or you happen to follow it.
Oh, okay. Well,
they're
sorry.
Oxymoronic,
I misspoke.
Aren't they?
I'm sorry. Misspoke. Or you're given the position that morality is whatever God says it is,
right.
In which case that's not objective, that's simply an ad hoc reasoning about morality.
Mm. I think
that's actually
it may be arbitrary, but it can also be objective. Why then, if I could get away with it, why could I not steal your wallet?
Well, I think that there are good reasons why you wouldn't want to steal my wallet. First of all, because I'd probably punch you in the face.
Well, but if I could... that's only a political
reason.
If I can steal your wallet, you don't know, I will never be caught. Why shouldn't I do it?
Well, I think because we have... it really comes down to an important question that, unfortunately, I don't think we have time to get into.
A couple of minutes.
Okay, well, it's an important question of what is the nature of morality in the beginning. And
yeah.
I think it's a set of theoretical imperatives, right? That we have to think out and rationally think out the consequences of our actions, right?
Michael, who issues these imperatives?
Well, actually, I think the imperatives come from a system of discussing them and being rational about them. I certainly don't think that these imperatives can or do come from a god, especially because we do see, and you'll have to admit this, that even religious people have great differences in what they believe to be ethical behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. But they believe in ethical behavior. They differ in what they believe to be ethical behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're saying there is no such thing as ethical behavior, or there is.
Oh,
and
no,
you,
I never
and you can
said
make it
anything.
Up as you go along. You never answered the question, though. Why, if I can get away with it, you won't be able to hit me, the law won't get me, why shouldn't I?
Well, what I started out with was saying that we need some nature of what moral statements are,
yeah.
Right? So from that basis, I would say that the reasoning why you wouldn't do it is because you'd have some minimal obligation to other people, right?
Why?
And, well, I think at some point, actually, moral arguments do have to drop off, right?
Mm.
And I think this is also true of the theist position, right?
Mm.
It's actually a logical fallacy to think that something is wrong just because I'll get beat up if I say so, or if I do it differently than the bully
says.
It's
a self-preservation argument, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, that's ultimately what I often feel theological ethics come
yeah.
out of, is this ultimate fear
okay.
of hell and
right.
of eternity. We're
out of time. By the way, I would recommend, though, you look at Sartre and de Beauvoir's justification of their lack of resistance to the Nazis in France. Whereas Christians who failed admit they failed, de Beauvoir and Sartre say, we didn't fail. Where is the logical rationale behind having to resist evil?
Well,
I wish we had more time. I've got a break. We'll come back with emails and goodbyes, and God will tell us if we've done well or not. See you soon. Kelly Donovan, Ottawa, Ontario. Michael, I really don't know why you continue to insist David Menzies hold back his thoughts. What? Especially on an issue like the use of the N-word. Why is he on the show if he can't say what he thinks? Have you seen some of the other garbage on TV these days? Yeah, of course I've seen some of the garbage. David says more than anyone else, and this is the one show he can speak his mind, but I don't think using the N-word in it fully is fine. Why, if you can... Anyway, I think you know what I mean. I think you know why you wrote the email. Thank you so very much. Dr. William Lane Craig, a pleasure. And Michael Payton, thank you so very much indeed. I do appreciate that. Tomorrow, Friday, TW3, that was the week that was. They'll be back. Until then, take care. God bless and goodbye.
Michael Corrin's wardrobe supplied by Stollery's, serving Canada's business community for over 100 years. Stollery's at Bloor and Yonge.